Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, research at the University of Lethbridge. As the research climate becomes more complex, the search for funding becomes more sophisticated. Dr. Dennis Fitzpatrick offers a peek at the challenges facing a vice president for research. And among the world's pioneers in the field of neuroscience are Ian Wishaw and Brian Kolb. Recently appointed research chairs at the University of Lethbridge, their work in brain injury and Parkinson's disease has helped bring the new Canadian Centre for Behavioral Neurosciences to the Lethbridge campus. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Tucked away in the southwest part of the province, the University of Lethbridge is probably one of Alberta's best-kept secrets. Scientists working on a wide variety of topics thrive on this tiny campus of 6,000, and they are world-renowned for their excellence in neuroscience, physics, and social sciences. Dr. Dennis Fitzpatrick is Associate Vice President for Research at the University of Lethbridge. An expert himself in microtoxins, Dennis now leads the hunt as Lethbridge goes up against much larger institutions in the competition for research dollars.
That's a problem. The more established universities have got a long track record and well-established research programs. The University of Lethbridge was formed in 1967 and is relatively new. We focused on developing strong research platforms from day one, and the University of Lethbridge's research groups are incredibly strong. What we end up doing when we go out for money is competing in a head-to-head manner with the University of Calgary and the University of Alberta and other universities in Canada for those funds. Everything is done on the basis of strength of the application and quality of the researchers themselves. If we didn't have highly qualified, very successful researchers, we would not access the kinds of monies that we do to support research. That's as simple as that.
How has the nature of managing research changed over time?
There's so much more competition for money and so much more competition for equipment and highly qualified people. I think the nature of research has changed in time in that we are moving from an age in which single researchers applied for their own individual research grant to the point where we're putting together groups of researchers to tackle very sophisticated questions. If you look at issues like water and the environment, at the University of Lethbridge, we're leading a research consortium of eight other research organizations within the southern Alberta area. We think that each one of these organizations is currently working in the water area in one part of this area. Our interests are in certain specific areas, whereas Agriculture Canada's research center within Lethbridge is looking at some of the more applied areas. By forming a research consortium like this, we put ourselves in the position where we avoid duplication and we can build on the efforts of others.
You've mentioned water. What other areas do you see the University of Lethbridge really standing out in terms of research that's being done here?
Well, the University of Lethbridge has an incredibly strong behavioral neuroscience group. The behavioral neuroscience group was led by a number of senior researchers who are looking at issues which are leading issues in heart, brain, stroke type research. Ian Wishaw, Brian Kolb, Rob Sutherland are perhaps three of the best researchers in North America in this area. So behavioral neuroscience is a strong area. We have other strong areas of research here. Another example that comes to mind is the example of the behavioral science group. We have got three incredibly strong primatologists here working on aspects of primate communications. That's a prime example. Drew Rendell in the psychology department works on primate communications, doing most of his work in Africa. But the group is much bigger than that. The three primatologists are joined by individuals who do work on Richardson ground squirrels and their behavior. The president of the University of Lethbridge actually does research on the behavior of crickets. We have a researcher who does work on birds and bumblebees. So we go everywhere from primates, animals very much like us, to ground squirrels, to insects.
When you're looking at what types of projects will get funding and those that won't, how do you decide between going after basic research or the importance of basic research compared to what's called applied research?
Well, the idea that applied research pays dividend has never been proven true by those people that actually do the actuarial analysis of where innovations comes from. And I always find it interesting that Industry Canada comes back with this notion that applied research pays off when their own data doesn't support it. I remember I was a graduate student in the United States when William Proxmire held out the Golden Fleece Award for research which was supported by the United States, which had no value. And I remember him standing up in the U.S. Congress giving the Golden Fleece Award to a scientist at the University of California that was studying the sex life of the medfly. Well, 2 years later, they had a medfly infestation. And the $6 billion fruit crop was in jeopardy because of the medfly. Well, this individual who'd been doing research, which is basic in nature and had no application, said, here's the solution. Here's how medflies reproduce. We put out these signals. The medflies will come to them, and we can sequester the problem. And he saved the crop. That's one dramatic example. The amount of money they spent on that was paid for over a million times fold because they had basic knowledge there. When New Zealand turned and did away with their basic research program and put all of their monies into application and application-based research, they lost many of their graduate students. They went overseas, and they lost much of their research capability. And New Zealand has had to come to Canada to hire people to restaff their universities because all of that was lost when the basic research programs were cut. I think it's always difficult to balance off what you're going to spend on basic research versus your more applied research, and that's almost a political consideration. But the fact is, if you don't have a solid basic research platform, you're not going to have a research future.
How do you approach your job when you make the decisions on what you're going to pursue?
It's fairly simple. We just go on the basis of research excellence. If someone brings us a really good idea, we will get up and run with it as hard and as fast as we can. We never know what is going to come from the creative minds of people, and that's what we deal with. Universities, their biggest asset is the creative minds of the students and academic staff. People come in all the time with outstanding ideas, and we just try to find a way to facilitate it. Sometimes it's a matter of leading, and sometimes it's a matter of just getting out of the way.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Please come back again.
That was Dr. Dennis Fitzpatrick, Associate Vice President for Research at the University of Lethbridge. Coming up, investigating the brain. Thanks to the pioneering work of Dr. Brian Kolb and Dr. Ian Wishaw, the University of Lethbridge is known around the world for its research into the workings of the brain. Just built on campus is the new Neurosciences Building. This will house the Canadian Centre for Behavioral Neurosciences. And this is where Dr. Brian Kolb will continue his work on strokes and brain development.
The new facility allows us to do multidisciplinary work. So in the past, we would have we'd focus on certain aspects of the problem, whether they were anatomical or chemical or whatever they were. But owing to space constraints and owing to financial constraints, we weren't able to really look at everything at once. The new facility allows us a major expansion, so we now have a new electron microscope, we have a new confocal microscope, we have an NMR machine that's available in the building. We have all sorts of new systems for protein analysis and behavioral analysis and physiological analysis. So what we're going to be able to do is to take advantage of all of these things at the same time. So going back to my example of nicotine, if you want to know what nicotine's doing, you can look anatomically, behaviorally, physiologically at the same time. That's a big advantage. The other advantage is that we have more space, and therefore we can fit more people in. And so we'll be expanding the research group from what was probably across all the labs, something like 40 people, to close to 100 people. Big difference.
This is actually quite a coup for you, isn't it, to get this facility here in Lethbridge and then to be the envy of a number of different centers?
We were lucky. The timing was right. It was well before September 11th, and so money was still available for this sort of thing. Part of it was the foresight of the then-president Tennant, who thought that this was something that the Canadian Foundation for Innovation might support, and they did. And we've basically built on the excellence of the people who were already here, been able to recruit more people. And this facility is probably, without stretching it, the best in Canada and beyond, focused on a particular problem, that is behavioral neuroscience.
You've just been named one of the research chairs here at the University of Lethbridge. What is it that you're going to be doing and looking at with this chair? What makes it significant?
My research involves two kinds of activities. The overall interest is in how the brain changes with experience. So if you learn anything at all, the brain must have changed in response to experience, and that's how your memory works. We're interested in development and how experiences change the brain during development. So, for example, if you have some sort of experience in utero, inside your mom, how did that change your brain? How does it affect how your brain reacts later? If you have experiences in infancy, same story. Now, one of the side shoots of this has been to look at drugs and to look at the actions of drugs both in utero, in early development, and later in adulthood. So, for example, if we just talk about adulthood, one of the big social problems is getting people to stop smoking. So what does nicotine do to the brain? Well, nicotine changes permanently the structure of certain cells in the brain. Is there any way to reverse that? Is there any way we can play with that? What effect does that have on addiction? Same story with amphetamine and cocaine. Similar changes to those in nicotine. Now, knowing how the brain is affected by experience allows us to do something, and that is to try and understand how we can repair the injured brain. So if a brain is injured, we want to stimulate change. So if we know how the brain normally changes, we can try and take whatever events normally change it and make them bigger. So, for example, if I know that the brain is altered by nicotine, and it may not be a good thing necessarily, but if I know that's one way to change the brain, maybe I can use it after an injury to my advantage. So one of the goals then is to try and take advantage of what we know in the normal brain and use it with the injured brain, both in adulthood and in infancy. This ties in with our work with the Canadian Stroke Network. So stroke is a major social problem in Canada that's going to get bigger and bigger as the population ages. Something like 50% of people who are caregivers for stroke victims will themselves require medical attention within a year. They're just exhausted. Usually it's psychiatric help because they're just so stressed out. So if we can actually figure out treatments that make it easier for people to cope with the stroke victim or for the stroke victim themselves to try and do somewhat better and be more independent, this is a major step forward. So that's the angle we're taking on this.
Where do you want to take this, the research that you're doing?
What we'd like to do is to figure out ways of repairing the injured brain, both in infancy and adulthood. And so I'm really interested in the infant brain because that's our future. And being born is actually quite a tough thing. And so lots of brains are perturbed during birth. We have lots of premature babies who many will have all sorts of learning problems and so on related to brain development. So if we can translate what we're doing into helping these kids, that would be a major step. The second thing we'd like to do is to translate the same kind of activities for stroke victims. And finally, what we really want to do is to understand the way in which the brain is shaped by the environment, because I think that can help us in designing a curricula for school, in dealing with drug addiction and so on.
Just looking at dealing with the problems of just being born, how would you even deal with that? Do you have some clues as to where you would best put your efforts to try and help these little kids along?
We have some ideas. We were actually stunned. Robin Gibb is one of my colleagues. She's been working with me for over 15 years, and we were stunned to discover that events that occurred immediately after birth, such as just tactilely stimulating infant rats with a little brush 3 times a day for 15 minutes, could actually alter their brain permanently. Now, we got the idea from the study of children in incubators. That was tried there to see if you could get them to develop faster, and you could. So there's an example of something that's very easy to do. And so we're manipulating that now to see if we add drugs to that, can we actually get the effects to be bigger? So in our animal studies, if we damage the brain at birth, we then apply the tactile stimulation with or without other treatments, such as nicotine, we actually can produce almost complete recovery on most cognitive behaviors. Now, the animals still have brain damage. They're not totally normal, but they're stunningly better than animals without the treatment.
Looking at the aging population, where you say stroke will become a bigger and bigger issue, what are some of the things there that we need to be looking at?
Well, the biggest thing we need to be looking at is compliance with doctor's orders. It turns out that only about a quarter of people who have high blood pressure bother taking their medication, and the same with cholesterol medication. They don't bother taking it. So if we can improve compliance, there's a place to start. But beyond that, we're interested in looking at the role of hormones. So most people who have strokes are going to be after 50, certainly. And so we have a hormone issue, especially with women. Should they be on hormone replacement or not? Do the hormones help or do they hinder recovery? Are there simple programs that we can initiate? You know, if your grandma has a stroke or your dad has a stroke or someone you know has a stroke, the first thing you're going to say is, well, we should get them in therapy, right? Some sort of physiotherapy, speech therapy. Is there any evidence that it actually works? And if it does work, why does it work? And how long should you give it? And when should you give it? So these are issues we're looking at in our animal models to try and see whether or not it does work. And it turns out that it does, but only under certain circumstances. So you need to know those circumstances, and you need to know what drugs might enhance the therapy. So that's a big thing for the stroke population.
What's the thing that's really mystifying you right now that has you scratching your head?
That's a tough question. I guess the thing that's mystifying me most is the mechanism that leads the brain to undergo these changes. So it's one thing to say, if you give people amphetamine or cocaine or nicotine or morphine or whatever it is, and the brain changes, the question is why? What actually causes it to change? When you put animals in certain environments and the brain changes, what actually causes that change? So that's quite mystifying, and it's something we're trying a whole variety of techniques, or using a whole variety of techniques to try and get at. We still don't understand why these changes occur. That's important in understanding how to use them to our advantage.
If we flip that around then, what is the most surprising thing to you?
The most surprising thing has been that prenatal experience actually alters the adult brain. The reason it's so surprising is that the prenatal experience is occurring on a brain that isn't working yet. So something that we're doing when we manipulate experience in utero, presumably through hormones, is altering the way the brain grows. This I would never have believed. It seemed to me that the effective experiences on the brain would require that the brain had become a brain, not that it was, you know, sort of a partial brain. When Robin suggested these experiments, I thought it was just dumb. And I give her full credit for telling me that we should at least try. And we keep getting effects. Very surprising.
Where do you see your research and this institute going in the future?
Well, I think that there'll be more applied research. When Rob Sutherland was hired as a Heritage senior scientist, he brought with him research on fetal alcohol and the effects of alcohol on the developing brain. He's doing clinical work as well as basic animal work. Wishaw is doing clinical work with Parkinson's patients as well as studying Parkinson's disease. I'm looking at stroke victims as well as looking at animals. So I see what's going to happen is an expansion into direct applications with clinical populations, which is unusual. Normally the basic research and the applied research are found in totally different locations.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Brian Kolb is a professor of psychology and newly appointed to a research chair in neurosciences at the University of Lethbridge. Coming up, his colleagues' research into Parkinson's disease. As a pioneer in behavioral neuroscience, Dr. Ian Wishaw has co-authored, along with Brian Kolb, one of the basic textbooks on the study of the brain. And as the first scientist to be recognized with an appointment to the Board of Governors Research Chair in Neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge, Ian Wishaw is looking forward to spending more time studying human hand movements and their relation to Parkinson's disease.
Well, I've been interested in hand movements for a long time. The common view of things is that only primates have very good hand movements, and only primates will pick up objects and handle them and put them in their mouth and eat. And in my studies on the rat, I noticed that they had very good hand movements. They'd reach out and they'd pick up objects, and they could move their fingers independently in very much the same way primates could do. And that got me very interested in the evolution of hand movements. So I've been studying evolution of movements in a large variety of animals. Mostly we get videos from zoos of different species of animals, carnivores, marsupials, you name it, we'll film it. And then we try to trace the history of hand movements within species. And we find that hand movements are highly conserved. Probably the first terrestrial vertebrates were able to use their hands to hold objects. And then subsequently some orders of animals, especially the primates and the carnivores and the marsupials, elaborated these hand movements until they become quite skilled. So accompanying the evolution of hand movements, of course, are brain centers that control the skills that the animals have. So I'm interested not only in the evolution of the hand movements, but also in the brain centers that control hand movements.
The type of hand movements that different species have, what does that say about the brain or the brain development?
Well, the brain is very similar, or the regions of the brain that control hand movements are very similar in a lot of different species. And for example, they're very similar in the rat and they're very similar in primates. And so humans and rats are quite comparable. And humans have more elaborate hand movements and they have a larger brain region controlling them. But the hands and the hand and the paw of a human and the rat and the controlling brain regions are very similar. And so if you want to study problems that humans have, disorders such as Parkinson's disease, which is one of my interests, you can use the rat as a model for studying that disease.
Well, what would it say then about something like Parkinson's?
Well, our interest in the rat and Parkinson's disease is Parkinson's disease is a disorder in which people have rigidity and they also have tremors in their hands. And there's no known cause of the disorder. There's no cure for the disorder. There's a treatment that works for a little while. So what scientists who study Parkinson's disease with animal models are interested in is can we find out what causes the disease so we can block it? And once people have the disease, can we find a treatment to alleviate the symptoms of the disease? And of course, you can't do those kinds of experiments with people, so you have to use animals. And the rat, because it's got very, very good motor skills, like a human, makes a wonderful subject for this kind of research.
What are some of the things that you're finding out?
Well, we train the rats to reach for little pieces of food, and they grasp the food and put it in their mouth. And then we have a very elaborate system for describing the movements that they make. There are about 10 different components of a reaching movement. Again, those components are similar in rats and people. And then if the rat is subjected to a treatment which makes it Parkinson-like, that becomes like a human with Parkinson's disease, those movements are impaired. So the impairment in the movements is equivalent to the symptoms that the human Parkinson patient shows. And then we can study the effects of various kinds of treatments or remedies using that animal. And We haven't discovered anything that will cure the impairment in a rat yet, but that's our eventual objective.
I just find it really curious that there isn't any sense of what might actually cause this disease.
Well, there are lots of theories. One theory is flu viruses can get into the brain, attack the substance in the brain called the substantia nigra, which is when it's damaged, that's what causes the disease. Some people may have genetic predisposition. Parkinson's disease is common in Alberta, and it's especially common around oil fields and agricultural areas, and so some people have suggested that toxins might be causative. It's also common around Montreal, again in farming communities. And recently people have discovered that a pesticide called rhodogen, which is a natural compound made by plants, can cause Parkinson's disease in rats. So that's not to say that this chemical is causing it in people, but it does suggest that it could be toxins that in some susceptible people are causative in the disease.
Is that something that you might be looking at here at the new facility that you have?
Well, we're planning to do some studies, and some of our colleagues are doing some studies with this insecticide, and the idea is to expose very gradually the animal to the insecticide and then to observe if they develop the symptoms. But we don't really need to do that. We already have very good models and very good ways of producing Parkinson's disease in rats. What we don't have are any ways of blocking the disease yet or any way of curing it, so we're really focusing on those two problems. How would you block the disorder, and how would you cure it once it occurs?
So what's the future hold for you in terms of the research you're going to be working on?
Well, in the Parkinson's disease, one of the really interesting things is that there are cells in the brain called stem cells, and these cells can turn into neurons. And they were just recently discovered by a group in Calgary, Brent Reynolds and Sam Wise. And prior to that discovery, people didn't really appreciate that new neurons could grow in the brain. But once stem cells were discovered, it opened the possibility to the fact that the brain could regrow cells. Now, in Parkinson's disease, cells are dying. So one possible cure is to find the set of instructions that originally made those cells, the ones that are related to Parkinson's disease, and instruct the stem cells to remake those lost cells. And so that's one focus of research. And that's probably, I think, in the long term, one of the most hopeful prospects.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Ian Wishaw is a professor of psychology at the University of Lethbridge, and he holds a research chair in neuroscience. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website. You can listen to past programs in real audio or download them from the web. That's at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.